You'll notice that he moved the microphone. I don't touch anything that has electricity in it. If you had as many shock treatments as I've had, you wouldn't either. That's something you... Some things you just don't ever forget. You know, I mean, just like... I'd like to make a correction to the program, if I may. They've noted that this is a spiritual meeting this morning. And every function we've had since Friday has been a spiritual meeting. There isn't any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous any more spiritual than another where two drunks are sitting together trying to help the other one get well. And if it does become that specialized here, I won't be here. Because the thing I love about Alcoholics Anonymous is that everything is equal here. And everybody's equal here. And that's something I never felt prior to 26 years ago when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank George and the committee and all the people who extended me the extreme privilege of being able to participate in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. You see, I've always considered it some type of a privilege to even be allowed to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have never been able to get it through my head that I've ever been able to be entitled to have this good life that I live today because of the grace of God and the miracle called Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I'm just as sure as I'm standing here that there are people in this world who are drunk right now, who are locked up someplace, who are trying desperately to kill themselves through this terrible malady that I have called alcoholism, who are far better people than I am. I know that there's people in this world who are far more deserving of this fellowship and this way of life than I am. I know that. It'd be without a shadow of a doubt. And I don't have the slightest idea what I ever did or whatever happened to me that would made it necessary or blessed enough for me to even come to Alcoholics Anonymous, let alone stay here from the first moment I ever laid eyes on you. I suppose it's because I've been looking for you all my life. I suppose that's the reason. Now, I didn't know that. And for a long, long time in my life, I never thought I'd ever find it. I thought I was just doomed to go and do what I was doing. I didn't know that. You see, I'm very pleased to be here this morning fully clothed in my right mind. And the reason I tell you that is for no particular reason other than the fact that the longer I stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more necessary it becomes for me to remember from whence I came. And I never want to forget that a little over 27 years ago right now, I was crawling around on my knees in a cell in solitary confinement in a maximum security penitentiary. And because of a loving God that expressed himself through this program called Alcoholics Anonymous, it's no longer necessary for me to crawl around my hands and knees like an animal. Now, if I don't get anything out of this deal, I could probably live with that all the way home. It makes me feel good. I'd like to be able to stand here this morning or anywhere else anybody would listen to me and be able to tell you with all types of sincerity and everything that I could muster that that's where alcohol and drugs took me to. Oh, God, I'd love to be able to tell you that. That's where I took me to. The only thing that alcohol and drugs did in my life, they kept me alive long enough to find you. I'm just as sure as I'm standing here that without alcohol working in my life, I'd have blown my brains out before I was 9 years old. As far back as I could ever possibly remember, I've been some type of an emotional left fielder. I've always been weird. I really have. I was born weird and got worse. I don't understand that. There's always been something missing. There was always something missing. There was always kind of a part of me that didn't quite fit in there. It was restless and irritable and discontent, and I didn't understand what I was always kind of. And I had this big wall of anger inside me. I didn't understand that, and it was never my fault anyhow. It's always their fault. And I had a lot of excuses down through my lifetime why I felt the way I felt then, but it was never my fault. I had a good excuse. From the start, I had a good excuse. I had a drunken mother, a drunken father, four drunken uncles, three drunken aunts, and a drunken grandfather. And I said, well, no wonder I feel different. I've been born beneath my station. These are bad people. I don't belong around them. That's just the way I felt. You know, I just felt that way. I kept looking around where I belonged. And I looked up one day and tried to find somebody. And I looked up and here's my grandmother. Now, my grandmother lived till she was 90 years old. And she never took a drink of alcohol or smoked a cigarette in her life. My grandmother lived in this house of insanity. But that's what it was. I mean, you know, they're in the other room, drunk and screaming and whipping on one another and throwing people through the wall. And grandma's dancing around in the kitchen singing, "Yes, Jesus loves me." You know, and I don't understand that. You know? And so my keen alcoholic mind went to work. Have you ever noticed that the only people who ever tell you that alcoholics have keen alcoholic minds are alcoholics? Nobody else ever seems to understand that. But my mind said to me, I must be like my grandmother. Listen to them people in there. See, whatever what had grandma had, I guess that's what I wanted. Because I didn't want what these other people had. I didn't feel like it. So I figured that all I was going to have to do is go where grandma goes and do what grandma does, and I'll be like grandma. Now, one day my grandmother said to me, "Johnny, I'm going to take you with me Sunday." And I remember how excited I was about that, because I never wanted to be the way I was, ever. I never wanted to feel the way I felt. I never wanted to think the things that I thought. And I never wanted to do the things that I did, ever. Because I always knew that I was wrong. Always. I always had that thing inside of me that told me I was wrong. There was always a thing down there. It didn't stop me from doing anything. I always knew it was wrong. But I never thought, all my lifetime, that I deserved anything any better anyhow. So why not? But this one day I said, "Man, it's going to be fine, because I'm going to go over and sit down with my grandmother around these other people. I'm going to get away from this environment, and I'm going to sit down with these people. I'm going to be fine. I'm going to be jumping around in here in the sea of insanity singing, 'Yes, Jesus loves me.'" That's the way I felt. And we went on the other side of town. We left these people that I felt different and strange and irritable around and hated. We went on the other side of town. We sat down with a completely different group of people, and I felt different and strange and irritable, and I hated all them too. I didn't understand that. And then I did something that I did all of my life, up until and including coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. I sit and waited for one of those quote and unquote superior people to tell me why I felt that way. And even more importantly than that, I wanted to tell me what to do about it. I remember him looking down where I was sitting and telling me I'm supposed to love and honor and respect my parents. He said, "You're supposed to love your brothers and your sisters." And I didn't. I hated them. I hated them for reasons I didn't even understand. And God, I felt guilty about that. I became frightened to death sitting in that church that people were going to find out I was hating when I was supposed to be loving, and I didn't know what to do about that either. I turned to walk outside the door of the church that day, my old man standing there drunk and hungover. He reached over and tapped me on the head and said, "Son, if you continue to go to church, you're going to grow up to be just like me." I ain't been back to church since. But I never wanted to be like my old man. I hated my old man. I hated him till 10 or 12 years ago when I went back and saw him and told him I was tired of hating him. Hated him. Because my old man was a drunk. And I lived in a house where there were two drunks working. If you've never lived in a nightmare like that, I'll explain it to you. Frightening place for little children. In the middle of the night in a house like that, they're screaming and yelling and cussing and flesh hitting flesh and breaking furniture and deathly silent. And that's not the terrible time. Terrible time's when they're gone. And you're there all by yourself. And you know they're coming in, and when they come in, they're going to get you. And you lay there with your thoughts. And you think about the things that are going on in your life that you don't understand. You think about your uncles who live in penitentiaries and your aunts who work in those houses on the other side of the track. You think about your old man who beats up your mother and your mother who beats up your old man. Think about all that kind of stuff. And one night it dawned upon me what the problem was. It's alcohol. They drink and they do those things. I'm not going to drink because I'm not going to be like them. I'm going to be better than they are. I'm going to step out into that world. I'm going to have something. I'm going to do something. I'm going to be something. What do you do if you're weird? Tell you what I did, I took a drink. It wasn't any big decision on my part. I just got into my old man's bootleg hooch and took a drink of alcohol. It was the most fantastic thing that ever happened to me in my life. It went down in there and just kind of tore all that madness from me. That's what alcohol did for me. Alcohol took me from the black pit of nothingness. It moved me into the gray fringes of the business of living and installed in me some type of arrogance that said, damn you, world, it's all right. Maybe I'm not good enough to be around the good people, or maybe I'm too good to be around the bad people, but it's okay right here. That's what alcohol did for me. Now, I'll tell you a strange secret. If alcohol still did that, I'd still drink it. And the reason I don't use alcohol or drugs anymore, they don't work. That's as simple as I know how to tell you. Now, the sad part about my life is, they quit working 10 years before I knew they did. I spent the last 10 years of my life wandering around out there trying to find the answer and the end of a hypodermic needle. 10 years after it quit working. And when I drank, there's nothing real complex about my story. I did the same thing all the time when I drank. You see, I don't know anything about not drinking. I don't know how to stop drinking. I really don't. I'm right up to this end. I'm almost 26 years without any type of chemicals in my system whatsoever. I don't even take aspirin. And right to this instant, I haven't quit drinking. Quit me. Guy came up to me at my home group the other night, and he said, Jesus, I don't know what to do. I can't quit drinking. What do you think I ought to do? I said, why don't you go hit a policeman in the mouth? Works for me. I took a drink of alcohol, and 3 days later, they pulled me out from underneath a bridge and stood me in front of a judge and sentenced me to the Hutchinson State Reform School, which is in Kansas. 20 years later, I took a drink of alcohol, they stood me in front of a judge and sentenced me to 20 years in the penitentiary. Every time I drank, that's what happened to me. I got drunk and went places. I was taken out of that reform school, my mother came and got me and took me to California. She said, we get to California, things are going to be different. They were. We left a one-room shack in Kansas. We went to California and got a one-room shack with a bathroom. Mama got me a couple of new uncles and introduced them to me. And I went out on a streetcar and got drunk. And I made a fantastic discovery. I found out that alcohol would do the same thing to me in California that it did in Kansas. And in my way of thinking, it was the only thing I'd ever found that ever did the same thing twice succession. I was tired of people telling me things they weren't going to do. I was tired of getting my hopes and dreams and aspirations that high off the ground, having come along and kick the stool out from underneath me. But I found out if I threw a brick through a window and got a bottle of Marco Petri red wine and drank it, it did exactly what I anticipated to do. It went down in there and tore that madness from me. It took me from there and it stood me there and it gave me that. And I got drunk and went to juvenile hall. I spent the next 3.5 years of my life in a running court battle with my mother, a lawyer, and a judge. Once a month, I went in front of a judge. Once a month, he sent me to the Whittier State Reform School. Once a month, my mother stood up with a lawyer and appealed. Once a month, my mother came to visit me, and she said, I love you, and I miss you, and when you come home, things are going to be different. Now, for a long, long time, I didn't buy that, because I'm already sticking the walls up. Stay out. You ain't kicking me around no more. You don't hurt me no more. Stay there. Leave me alone. Somewhere during that 3.5-year period of time, I switched over and started to believe my mother. And the reason I started to believe my mother, I wanted so desperately to believe my mother. You see, I wanted so desperately to believe that the answer to my problem was in a little white house with a little old lady with a tray full of cookies and milk. And all I was going to have to do is show up and eat those cookies and be wonderful. See, and I understand that today, why I thought that way. I understand with my alcoholic thinking and my disease of alcoholism why I thought that way. You see, if that was true, if that's true, then I can do anything I want to do to anybody I want to do it to for as long as I want to do it. Then show up and eat cookies and be wonderful. It doesn't work that way. It just doesn't work that way. But I thought so. And after a period of time, I was put in a boys' home in the San Fernando Valley. And when I got there, the superintendent told me if I was a good kid, I could go home on a home trip in 30 days. God, I was good. They loaded us on an old truck and they brought us out of the valley. It was an all-day trip. I remember how excited I was. No more differences, no more apart from. Everything's going to be wonderful. After transferring from streetcars and running from here and running from there, I finally showed up at my mother's house and there was a drunken party going on there. Nothing changed, except me. I'd spent 3.5 years in juvenile hall. I'd heard a lot of strange things. I'd heard things like everybody's a liar and everybody's a cheat. Never believe anybody used to tell me because that's a sign of weakness. Never show anybody you care for them they used to tell me because that's weakness. And more important than anything else, never reach your hand up out of the gutter because the minute you do that, they come along and kick you in the teeth. Now, I didn't want to believe that because there was something deep inside of me that said that's not true. I walked out of my house that day, my mother's house that day, and made a vow to myself I lived to be 500 years old. I'd never show anybody any human emotions again. And I went on a streetcar and got drunk. I went back to school, come home next month, and got drunk again. Long about that time in my life, I became a periodic. Well, I was forced to be a periodic. They only let me out once a month, so I only got drunk once a month. It was the same thing. I'd come home, throw a brick through a window, get a bottle of Marco Petri red wine, and get drunk, and go back to school. And my first week in school was fine. I was a scholar. I read inspirational books. My second week in school was fine. I was an athlete. I took strenuous exercise. My third week in school is when the madness set in because I started to think. I started to think about showing up in a neighborhood. I started thinking about walking up to my gang. My gang's wanting me to be their leader. I don't want to be their leader. I keep saying to myself, I wonder what the gang would say if I was to tell them I don't want to be a gangster. I want to be a doctor, a lawyer, an architect, or an engineer. I wonder what they would say. I wonder what they would say if I was to tell them I don't want to go out and hit people in the head. I want to go play baseball. I wonder what they would say. But see, if you're like me, and you're nothing, and you're glued over there against the corner of the wall, you're trying to figure out that magic thing that frees you from there and stands you up and gives you that. You think about that, and the answer comes. It's a bottle of Marco Petri red wine. So one day I sit down on the street corner with this anticipation and this madness all about me, and I open my bottle of wine. I drank a gallon of it. I'm sober as I am right now. Frightened to death. My magic wasn't magic anymore. I didn't know what to do about that. A guy come along and tapped me on the shoulder and said, why don't you try these? And he gave me some pills. I found out if I ate pills and drank wine, I could make the madness go away for a little while. And it wasn't very much longer after that, sitting on the same street corner with a sack of pills and a gallon of wine, nothing was working. And a guy come along and tapped me on the shoulder and said, why don't you try this? And he gave me some morphine. I found out if I put morphine in my arms and swallowed pills and drank wine, that I had a combination of things to sustain me for the next 14 years of my life. It was never one or two, it was a combination of all of it. I became too old to stay in that school. I came out of my neighborhood to become a gangster. That was my ambition in life. I wanted to be the Irish Lucky Luciano of Willowbrook. But I had a problem I didn't stand up to often. That's not conducive for being a gangster. You have to look alert when you're out there doing anything. You can't run in here and say, stick them up and puke on somebody. That really don't have a ring of machoism about it. You know, you don't gather up my neighborhood and talk about puking. You gather up my neighborhood and talk about being tough. And the reason you talk about being tough is because you're scared to death. Somebody's going to find out you're scared to death. And you got to do a lot of things when you're that frightened. Things you don't want to do, but if they find out, what will they say? And that's the kind of attitude I carried. I carried it all the time. It just got worse and worse. I kept going in and out of jail. In 1951, I stood in the old Los Angeles County Jail on my way to the penitentiary for the first time. And my mother standing on the other side of the vision screen screaming at me that I'm a murderer. It seemed that my 17-year-old brother had gotten some of my poison, taken an overdose of, and died. I didn't know how to handle that. I handled like I handled most things. I just shined it off somewhere. 3 days later, they stood me out underneath a tree and they handcuffed me between two detectives and they buried my baby brother. Now, I got all the guilt and shame and humiliation and degradation of a lifetime hanging on me that you can possibly have. And I want to cry, but I don't know how. I don't have the simple gift of tears that God gives every creature that's born on the face of this earth. And the reason I don't have them is because I don't think they're necessary. I went on to the penitentiary. I stayed there 4.5 years. I came out of 4.5 years sicker than I was when I went in there. I spent the next couple of years of my life trying to prove what a psychiatrist in San Quentin told me wasn't true. He said, Johnny, people like you don't change. Says, you're doomed to die in an institution. He took me down and showed me a little green room one day. He says, you're going to end up here, hotshot. And I told him, not me. I'm different. I come walking out of that institution, bound determined I had that deal beaten. 6 months later, I'm laying in a nut house, kicking and screaming. And that's when I made my round to some of the better laughing academies in the country, interviewing psychiatrists. I used to talk to them. We'd sit there. I'd sit there with my wraparound overcoat. And they'd talk to me about my mother. And I'd talk to them about their mother. And then they introduced me to a thing called better living through electricity. You know, now one time, you know what they used to tell me, all them monkeys? They told me I had an attitude problem. They told me I had a bad attitude. And then every once in a while, they'd sprinkle in a little thing like, you know, you shouldn't drink. You shouldn't eat them pills. You shouldn't stick those needles in your arm. If you didn't do that, you'd be all right. Finally, my journey led me to a place in Fort Worth, Texas, a federal government nut house. Isn't that nice? Federal government hospital. I forgot who it was that says how we dress up everything. Somebody called them a drunk farm, now they're treatment center. But Bob. I also get a kick out of this detox. You know the greatest thing that an alcoholic ever found for detox? It's a toilet bowl. I know you're not saying detox, but that's what works. They shuffled me into this little room in Fort Worth, Texas this day, and I remember going in there and sitting down, and they just treated me for my illness again, a few bolts here and there. And they shuffled me in there, and I'm sitting there, and I look up against the wall behind this man's desk. And I never saw so many plaques and degrees and diplomas in my entire lifetime. He had a whole wall full of them. And being the type of person I was and being conditioned society like I was, I thought that meant he knew something. Because he had all those things. And I thought maybe this is where the answer is, because I'm through now. The answer is I'm dead. I'm all over with. I'm nothing. I'm a shell wandering around looking for a place to lay down now. And I sit there, and I remember this guy looking across the desk from me, and I remember staring at him in anticipation. I remember him looking at me and saying to me, Johnny, if you didn't drink these things and swallow these things and smoke these things and shoot these things, you wouldn't have any problem. And as sick as I was sitting at that man's thing, I knew that that wasn't my problem. I've always known that. You know what my problem was? I was nothing. Of course, I've always been nothing. I came from nothing. I was nothing. I was going to be nothing. I used to put something in me, I became almost. To a nothing, almost is top of the world. Here's a guy trying to tell me a nothing that the thing I put into my system is a problem when I know the problem is I'm nothing. That's like trying to tell a guy when the building fell down, the elevator was defective. I'll tell you what that proved to me. That proved to me how unique I was. That there wasn't anybody else upon the face of the earth like me. So I went back to Los Angeles to die. I came that close. A little over 28 years ago, they strapped me down a bed in the Los Angeles County Jail. I weighed 128 pounds and I was yellow, and a medical doctor stood at the foot of my bed and told me I was going to die. Son, you're going to die, I said. There's nothing we can do for you. And I said, okay. All day passed and all night passed. He come running back into my room the next morning, looked at his little chart, and he said, son, you're going to die. There's nothing we can do for you. And I said, okay. The third day come wandering into my room, I had a terror grip me that I've never known before since. The idea came to me that I was going to live and not die. I was going to get up out of that bed and I was going to go to the penitentiary and I was going to come back out and start that rat race all over again. God knows I didn't want to do that. I was tired. I laid there for 18 days and 18 nights. I didn't need sleep, drink, or do anything. I just laid there. And one night, because I knew nothing better to do, I screamed out the only prayer I ever said in my life. I said, oh, God, help me. Now, I thought for a long, long time nothing had happened, because there was no blinding flashes of light. Nobody come running down the hall with a dozen donuts saying we got an AA meeting down there. Little bird didn't come in and drop the fifth chapter on my chest. I just went to sleep for a little while. And I don't know how many of you ever kicked a two-year heroin habit, but that's what I was doing. That's the first time I've been asleep in a long time. I tell you how sick I was. 2 weeks. 2 weeks after I'd screamed out that prayer in my deathbed, I'm up running around in jail looking for some more of the poison putting me back on the bed I'd just gotten off of. That's how sick I was. I'm still looking for the answer where there ain't no answers. But the illusion that took me into the gates of insanity and death was the idea that it worked once. It's got to work again sometime if I just get the right combination again. That's the illusion that took me to the gates of insanity or death. I'm looking for an answer out there, and there ain't no answers out there. I'm looking for them because once upon a time, there was an answer. And that's the illusion. I stood in front of a judge and was sentenced to 20 years in penitentiary. Didn't mean anything to him. He changed his conversation to a lady sitting in the courtroom. And he said to her, "Lady, if you care anything at all about the child you carry inside of you, you'll get so far away from this scum, he'll never be allowed to lay eyes on him. He's a blood-sucking parasite in society. He doesn't have any right being around decent people. If it was in my power, he's never going to be." And I'm sitting there saying, "He can't be talking about me. That must be my old man or my uncles or my grand." He was talking about me. He put into words what I'd spent a lifetime trying to hide from the world. What I was. What I really was. Because I always knew what I was. That thing way down inside of me that I kept pouring those chemicals on top of to hide is what I always knew that I was. No amount of booze or dope or anything else could ever take that illusion away from me. I always knew. Always. That's the thing that drove me crazy. And the evidence of that man's statement was so damning that I spent the next 9 months of my life in solitary confinement. And on the first Sunday in November, 1959, I wandered into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on a Sunday morning. I take no credit for coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I take no credit for staying here from that day to this day, because if I'd have known where I was coming, I wouldn't even have come. The reason I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because the institution I was in allowed women to come in there. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous almost 26 years ago to smell perfume. And I've been honking and sniffing around her ever since. You really got to be careful what gets us sick people in here. I remember my first impression of Alcoholics Anonymous. I moved in and sit down in the back row on what I lovingly like to call my throne of contempt. I had my coat collar up and my shades on because I was cool. If I'd have been any cooler when I got here, I'd have froze to death, for God's sake. I remember looking up on the backboard. I saw two big A's, and I thought to myself, "My God, I've wandered into an anti-aircraft brigade." I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I said to this clown sitting next to me, "What is this?" He says, "It's Alcoholics Anonymous." I sunk down in my seat. Gangsters weren't supposed to be hanging out with them winos. If it had been Gangsters Anonymous or Over Hip Anonymous or Doo-Doo's Anonymous, anything. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I didn't know what one was, but I didn't want to be one. So I thought to myself, I'll sit around and wait for the women to tell their racy story. And they got up and threw me a curve. Because they had sort of a twinkle in their eye and a smile on their face, and they sort of radiated something I didn't understand. And right away, they run and just start talking about God. And when I came to you and you talked to me about God, I got up and ran out of the room because God was the reason I was. It was not my fault. You see, I'd run out of people, places, things, circumstances, and conditions to blame for my dilemma. But when you run out of things like that, you can always have a perfect whipping post. It can be God's fault. See, he don't talk back. You listen to it sometime in Alcoholics Anonymous. Listen, I hear people talk about it all the time. I guess if God wants me to have a job, he'll shoot it down here to the club. Next time you get hungry, you go lock yourself up in a closet and pray for a hot dog. When God squirts you one through the keyhole, you call me. I'll be on the next plane to wherever you're at. I've been looking for a deal like that all my life. I'll tell you what I've come to understand about God and Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll tell you, and this is all I know about it, because I'm no spiritual giant. All I know is this, that God will not do anything for me that I can do for myself. Nothing. And there's been one single thing in my entire lifetime prior to seeing you that I could not do. I could not keep from taking a drink. Myself. Now, for almost 26 years of my life, since I first laid eyes on you, I haven't had a conscious thought or a conscious desire to take a drink of alcohol or any type of chemicals in my system. That is what God has done for me. Now, my God, as I understand it, expresses himself to me through you, because I don't know anything about all them other mystics. The word God scared me to death when I came to alcoholics. It ran me out of meetings. But my disease ran me right back in there. And the thing that brought me back to my meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous It's the same thing that brings me back to my meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous today. It's his people. That's why I keep coming back here, because you're here. If you weren't here, I wouldn't come. I won't go anywhere that you aren't. And that's become my great love affair in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had none of those attributes or none of those things when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I kept coming back to his people. Coming back because his people were there. They talked about God, and I left, and I was uncomfortable, and I was restless, and I was irritable, and I was discontent, and I was different, and I was all those things. But I kept coming back to your meeting. There was something here. I didn't know what it was. You had something. Not all of you. Some of you had something. Some of the people who came to this institution, an old man who used to giggle and kiss me on the cheek. Now, when you're a big-time gangster and a dope fiend in a penitentiary, and an old gray-headed fool hugs you and kisses you on the cheek, you get away from me. The kind of stuff you doing here. And he'd giggle at me, and he loved me. And I didn't know that the old man was going to set the standards by which I was going to live the rest of my life by either. But that's what I did. One Sunday a long, long time ago, I guess it's the day I'd live my lifetime for. I don't know. A little guy that I knew did 23 flat years in the penitentiary, stood at a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous and told me the thing that I'd been waiting all my life for somebody to tell me. He told me that I didn't have to live that way anymore if I didn't want to. He says, you don't have to do it like this no more. Nobody had ever told me that. They've been telling me all my life, don't drink, swallow, smoke, and shoot. But they didn't tell me how to live without doing it. After the meeting, I went up to the little guy and said, how did you learn how to live? That's all I wanted to know. And he told me about a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not looking for a way to sober up the world or cure all society's ill. I'm looking for a way to live peacefully and comfortably and joyously with me and the loving God that made me. Now, the strange phenomenon that takes place in my life is this. The closer I adhere to the principles that are written in that book, and the more willing I become to share that knowledge in this fellowship, just for the sheer joy of doing it, the more peaceful and the more comfortable and the more joyous I live with me and the loving God that made me. Well, I had a lot of trouble when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You've got to have a lot of trouble if you come to Alcoholics Anonymous if you're not an alcoholic and you're different. I was different. I dressed different. I talked different. I acted different. And I was different. But I was prideful in my differences. And the more prideful I became in my differences, the sicker I got. And the sicker I got, the more prideful I became. And I'd sit back there on my throne of contempt, and I'd hear things like, I used to drink, now I don't drink anymore, and everything is wonderful. I'd say, I guess I'm not alcoholic then. I'm not drinking either, and I'm crazy. I didn't understand. I don't understand it today. I was nuts. I was as physically sober as the person who told me that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was as physically sober as I am right now that day I came here. And they say, I don't drink, that's wonderful. It wasn't happening to me. I used to hear things in AA meetings I didn't understand. I hear people say, you got to get active in AA. I didn't know what active was. 2 or 3 days later, I snuck up on the secretary when nobody was around. I didn't want anybody seeing me talking to that AA secretary. Then I asked him the big question. I said, I hear you got to get active in AA. And he says, that's right. I said, I want to know what I can do so nobody will know I'm a member. You got to understand, I was pretty sick what I got. He said to me, what? I said, I want to know what I can do over there in that AA so nobody knows I'm a member. He said, John, you really are sick, aren't you? John, dead serious. Dead serious. And I want you to know I use the word dead because I was close to that. See, what I wanted when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't even know. I don't know. I don't know what I wanted. You said you were sober, so was I. Sober's not what I wanted to be. I never wanted to be sober. Sober's when the nightmares took off. Sober's when the faces of the people I'd harmed and the things I'd done were sitting there I couldn't get rid of. Sober's when that long arm of remorse and guilt reached down and grabbed me in the gut and ate me up. That's what sober was. I didn't want, that's what I had. There were some people who came to that institution. This old man was one of them. He had something. I didn't know what it was, but maybe that's what I wanted. But whatever it was I wanted when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought I could have it and live my own lifestyle. You see, I still thought I could be hip, slick, keen, and cool. I still thought I could be a taker of things, an abuser of people, a taker, and I could still stay sober. That's what I thought. See? You know what will happen to you if you stay in Alcoholics Anonymous for 26 years? Try to the best of your ability to practice these principles in your life one day at a time. Give it to anybody that wants it. You know what will happen to you? This program will de-hip you. You know how I know that? My 23-year-old daughter calls me a square. That's what she said. She said, "Daddy, you're a square." I said, "Thank God I've made it." I almost died out there, hip poke. And I'll tell you something even more frightening to me than that. I almost died here, hip. I was almost too hip to make this program. I wanted to snap my fingers and wander through Alcoholics Anonymous and be hip, slick, keen, and cool. I didn't want to do anything them old fools did when I came here. You know what happened to me? I'll tell you what happened to me. A program of recovery called Alcoholics Anonymous, which is a vast difference from its fellowship. The difference is there. What happened to me is a program of recovery. It's in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, Program of Recovery. And I didn't work the program of recovery recovery of my disease of alcoholism because I was wonderful and because I wanted to stay sober. I attempted to work the program of recovery in my life to prove to you I was different. This program wouldn't work for me. That's why I did it. I couldn't take the first step. I couldn't get the word alcohol out of my mouth when I came here. I couldn't admit that my life was unmanageable. I've been a ward of the state of California for 20 years. I was doing a real good job with it. I couldn't make a decision. Did you ever try to see a newcomer make a decision? I was having trouble today. Trying to figure out whether to bring one cup or two cups of coffee up here to the podium with me. So what kind of decision I made, I got a half a cup there. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they told me the book of Alcoholics Anonymous was like a big old toolbox. There's a wrench in it to fit every nut that walks in the door. And there's one that got me. It's called a searching and a fearless moral inventory. Now, I didn't do that to get wonderful or to get sober. I did that to prove to you I was different. And when I started to write that inventory and put that stuff down on paper, I became dangerous to me. I was afraid to shave. I was afraid to get around anything sharp. Because all those little nickel and dime and penny ante and petty compromises that I'd made all my life were starting to show up in that paper. Well, I'd already bragged about the real macho stuff, you know, whooping people and robbing folks and stealing money and doing all that kind of stuff. But I wrote down in my inventory with all those little nickel and dime penny ante compromises I'd made all my life. Things like crawling around on floors in the middle of the night stealing my little nephew's piggy bank so I could get $5 to go out and buy some dope to stand on the street corner and tell everybody what a big score I'd made the night before. That's the way I used to do things. There were times I made big scores, but there was an awful lot of time when I did them other little petty things and lied about them and hid them way down deep inside of me. And when I got this thing till I couldn't stand me no more, I sit in a room and told a man about every rotten, filthy, corruptible thing I'd ever done in my life. And somewhere during that interview with that man in my fifth step, I heard myself admit to him I was an alcoholic. And it started way down deep inside of me, and it came out of me, and with it came a freedom that I carry with me to this very day. Because for the very first time in my entire lifetime, I discovered what was wrong with me. I never knew. I never knew that I suffered from a disease called alcoholism. I never knew that at all. And the reason I didn't know that is because the disease of alcoholism has a word that I was prejudiced against. It's called alcohol. That's the thing that kept me in bondage most of my life, trying not to be like my people. That's why I did. I discovered this disease that I am afflicted with is restless and irritable and discontent when I'm not drinking. And that's the way I'd been all my life. I discovered in the second chapter of our book of experience called Alcoholics Anonymous that there was a solution for people like me. So I could take this simple spiritual kit of tools and I could apply them to my life and I could put this terrible malady that was killing me and driving me crazy, I could put it to rest one day at a time for as long as I live. I discovered that. And people came into my life that had no reason being in my life when I started to do these simple things and teach me about things that nobody had ever taught me about, saying things to me that nobody had ever said to me. There was a guy who said, some people who set me in a little room. And about that time in my life, my vocabulary consisted of about four-letter words. Mother ran all around in here somewhere with the triggers, made it all go. And they would say things like this to me. Johnny, do you know what cussing is? And I'd say, no, what is it? They said, it's a crutch for conversational cripple. And then I'd say to them, oh, what am I supposed to do about it? They say, if you're serious, we'll help you. And I was serious because I was in a process of change. And I didn't know I was in a process of change. I was doing these simple things, and things were happening in my life that I had no control over. They were just doing things. Things were happening to me. I was in a state of evolution, if you will. That's the way I feel Alcoholics Anonymous has been. I've been in a state of evolution. I've evolved out of the slime. That's what's happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I haven't done anything. I haven't ascended anywhere. I haven't gone on and beyond anywhere. I have done what you have asked me to do, and things have happened in my life. I haven't done anything else. The only thing that's been added to my life in my entire lifetime is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Nothing else, because I don't go anywhere else. I don't do anything else. This is all I do. This is the only thing that I have ever seen that has ever attracted to me, and I come here because of you. And I do what you tell me to do, and something happens to me. It's the most amazing, miraculous thing, even though I know it won't work. Yeah. I tell you, this is amazing, this thing. I told them, they said, we'll help you. I tell you, what do you mean? I always talk this way. I don't know any other way to talk. And then I'd scream and yell at them and throw things at them when they said, we don't say it that way, Johnny. We say it this way. And 24 years ago, last June, they opened up the doors of that penitentiary and let me out of there. I went into a world I don't know anything about. Never been in. Didn't know what to do out there. Oh, I know all about living in institutions. I know all about being locked up and playing them games. Doing. I didn't know what to do out there. An old man from Alcoholics Anonymous took me to my mother's house. She fell off the steps blind drunk. And I picked her up and put her on the couch and said, Mom, I'm going to an AA meeting. She said, fine, I think you should. Took my mother a long time to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm very proud today to tell you, when she's sober, she goes to meetings. She don't stay sober, but that ain't any of my business. I've come to understand that somebody else getting sober or staying sober ain't any of my business anyhow. I don't have the power to get anybody sober. I don't have the power to get them drunk either. Where would I get any power? I didn't come here with any. The book, the only authority in Alcoholics Anonymous, says that all I've got is a daily reprieve. That's it. I got it right now. I can't guarantee you I'm going to make it to my room. Can't guarantee that. I got it right now. This is it. It's a right now program. I got no yesterdays, no tomorrows are here yet. I live right now. I've got it whittled down that simple. Right now is where I live. I didn't know that. And if I live contingent upon my maintenance of certain spiritual conditions in my life, I'm given a power. A power is given to me through you in rooms like this that allows me to live peacefully and comfortably and joyously one more day of my lifetime. I don't get that power anywhere else. That's why I keep coming back to meetings. That's why I find it necessary to go to 5 or 6 or 7 meetings a week sometime for the last 26 years. That's why I find it still necessary in Alcoholics Anonymous after all these years to follow the directions of my sponsor. That's why I still find it necessary to go to a book study meeting and study this program of recovery that works in my life. Why it's necessary for me to do the things that I do in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I ain't never had it so good. And I'm afraid I'm going to miss something. I got a disease called alcoholism. It's called more. I want more. And I'm just as sure as I'm standing here, the best day of my life hasn't even gotten here yet. And I just can't hardly wait for that to happen. Do you know what they asked me to do? They wanted me to go to work. You know, I didn't know how to do nothing. Guy finally took pity on me and gave me a job working in the oil fields. And I showed up there to go to work. I was ready. He said, what's your Social Security card number? I said, what? I was real proud about that. He said, how old are you, boy? And I said, I'm 30. Sergeant, I said, no. And he said, why not? I said, I've never needed one. He said, what have you been doing all these years? I said, you wouldn't understand if I told you. He gave me a job and took me down and got me a Social Security guard work and put me to work. I almost killed me out there at the mall. And I stand around in little markets and liquor stores and watch what they do when they get paid. You know what they do, don't you, when they get paid? They go get Mom and the kids, and they put the kids in them little wagons, and they wheel them up and down the aisles of those markets, and they put them in groceries. I remember I got my first paycheck, and by this time my wife had come back, and she's got this little girl. And so I go home, and I say, let's go. She said, where are we going? I said, we're going to the market. She said, we don't need nothing. I said, we're going anyhow. That's what they do when they get them. And I went over and got her, and we loaded up the kid, and I pushed her, you know, give her candy and all that kind of stuff, you know, the way they did it. That's the way they were doing it. We got home, an hour later, I went to get some money from her to get a haircut, and somebody stole her purse. Now, if you want to hear somebody scream, you ought to hear a thief when they get stolen from them. Gee. I ranted and raved and jumped and hollered when I was completely beside myself and exhausted. I'll tell you, if I could have found that guy, there'd be a different talker here this morning, I'll tell you that. I sat down, and she said, you all through? And I says, yes. She said, now you know how it feels. You know, I went back to work that afternoon, and I've been working ever since. I haven't missed any more paychecks. I'd like to be able to stand here and tell you that every day I've lived has been a glorious, wonderful day. And I've been skipping through the tulips, and you know how some of them folks are here? I wandered into A&A, and plugging a jug, and I've settled down in that seat, and the sweet bird of happiness has settled over me for the last 25 years. When them guys used to talk, I used to go sit in their seat. I thought maybe that's where he was coming next, because he wasn't working over there, was he? I've come to understand some simple things in Alcoholics Anonymous, being that I've been living out there among them for a long time. I've come to understand that the only thing you ever get to be here in Alcoholics Anonymous is basic human being. That's basically what my program is designed to do for me. It's basic to turn me into a basic human being, which means that I have faults, and I have fears, and I have doubts, and I have guilt, and I have feelings, and I have emotional conflicts, and most important than anything else, I'm not immune to what's going on out there in the world, because I'm in the world. You know, I'm right there. And I haven't got any type of immunity hooked over me just because I ain't drinking alcohol, because I come to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I get it all out there. I get to live with all that stuff. But what I've also been given in Alcoholics Anonymous, by the grace of God and a miracle called Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been given a program of recovery that affords me to live out there in that world I don't understand anything about, with all the emotional conflicts of life that come upon me one day at a time, and everything with my wants and my fears and my guilt and my aloneness and all the things that happen to people like me out there in the world, I'm able to live with them one day at a time, and I'm able to bring those problems to my sponsor and bring the solutions of those problems to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I do here. I take my problems to my sponsor. I bring my solutions to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't sit here in bad mouth and tell you how out everything is, because this is a program of recovery. I'm sober. I've been sober. I have had to be locked up. I haven't had to have any shock treatments. I haven't had to live in one of them flea bag hotels. I haven't had to have any of that kind of stuff that you heard about this week for a long, long time, by the grace of God and the miracle called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't understand some of the things that go on here. I really don't. I've been here a long time, and I sit here, and I'm just as baffled as some of the newcomers, because I always think like a newcomer. I think like a newcomer, because I don't ever want to be anything but a newcomer. And I hear people come in here and say, oh, I used to love my family before I drank, and I drank, and I'd keep loving my family. I have no quarrel with that. I can't make the statement. I didn't love anything before I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I never used the word. The word was not of my vocabulary. And I'll tell you why. For the same reason I don't understand people say, I used to believe in God, but I just couldn't understand it while drinking out there and believing in God. I can't even make that statement. I don't understand that either. And the reason I don't understand that is because all of my life, all of my entire life prior to seeing you, I never thought about anything or anybody other than me. That's all. I thought about what a rotten deal I got when I was a kid. I thought about the drink after I took a drink, what happened to me. I thought about me when I was in institutions, how I was going to get out. That's all I ever thought about. Me, I. There ain't no room for no love or no God in a situation like that. There's only room for me. Now, through this process of elimination and this program of recovery called Alcoholics Anonymous, on a basis once in a while, I'm allowed to take my eyes off of me and put them on you. I'm given the extreme privilege in Alcoholics Anonymous to work with new people in Alcoholics Anonymous, to share my experience, strength, and hope with them, to take them down this path that you took me down. And the sum total of that, somewhere along the line, as a direct result and the byproduct of this program working in my life, I've come to believe in a God of my very own. I've come to have some love for me, for his people here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I love you. And to make that statement to you, I owe you the very best I know how to be. And the very best I know how to be is the way I am right now. I'm sober. And I'm an active, participating member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the best me I know how to be. I don't know how to be anything like Jolly Joe Citizen out there. I don't know how to do that because I haven't learned all those little games. We didn't teach them in the penitentiary. It was a law of survival. And that's what I am in Alcoholics Anonymous. See? I have a hard time separating some things in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a hard time separating you, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and God. I just have a hard time doing that. And the reason of it is I cannot, within me, think about God without thinking about you. I cannot actually think about you without thinking about this program of recovery that's happened in my life. So to me, you, Alcoholics Anonymous, and God as I understand him are synonymous. It's humanly impossible for me to think about one without thinking about the other. It's humanly impossible for me to think about anything without thinking about you. I can sit and think and think about people that I know in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I get so full, I want to cry. I'm thinking about an old friend of mine who don't live very far from here. His wife is very sick, and I've had him on my mind all week. And I sat up in my room, and I said a little prayer for him a while ago, and the tears just came out of my eyes because I love him so much. You see, those were not my feelings. I had none of those feelings prior to coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. And somewhere along the line in these 26 years that I've been hanging around with you and trying to follow your example, these things have become part of me. And being a part of me, they become part of you. Because what you see here this morning is the example, good, bad, or indifferent, does this program work? That's all. Everybody that knows me knows that I love to play golf. I like to play golf. If I've got an and left, it means I'm an alcoholic and a golfer. That's about the only and that's left in my life anymore. And a few years ago, a company I worked for bought me a membership in a very exclusive country club. One Wednesday, I'm out there playing golf with some doctors. Well, that's a story all itself, being those doctors. And I'm walking down these fairways, and I got short sleeve shirts on my arms. I got things like daggers through skulls with blood dripping from them. And Panther, I got real exciting stories in the coffee shop to talk to about my tattoos. And anyhow, little doctor says, "You got big forearms, Johnny." And I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "Did you ever play baseball?" I said, "Every time I went to jail." He said, "You've never been in jail," and I didn't tell him any different because I just never been my thing. And I'm kind of glad because over a period of years, this little man has told me a story. He's a little Jewish orphan in the Bronx in New York, and he took himself out of that orphanage, and he worked and studied and sacrificed, and he took himself out of that orphanage. And he worked and he studied and he sacrificed, and he put himself through college. Then he worked, and he studied, and he sacrificed, and he put himself through medical school, and he became a doctor, and he joined the country club, and he plays golf on Wednesdays, and that's his deal. All his life, he's worked, and he studied, and he sacrificed, and he did without, and he joined the country club, and he plays golf on Wednesday. I have no way of telling him. But I spent my entire lifetime running up and down the streets, in and out of penitentiaries and nut houses, and I got sober and ended up in the same place he did. And the reason I can't tell him is because he won't believe me. He won't. He cannot picture me the way I was and the way you know I was. He can't picture that. He just can't. I've tried to tell him. I've even showed him the scars on my arms. He don't believe that either. He said that was infection from the tattoo. You don't understand? Because that's what society doesn't understand. Society says that you have to work and you have to study and you have to sacrifice and you have to do without and blah, 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 blah. When I came here, I asked you about my sobriety, which is the only thing that I've ever been interested in, and it's the only thing that I'm really interested in this morning is my sobriety. And you said to me that my sobriety was a gift from God. And I thought about that for a long, long time, and I didn't believe in God very much. And I said to this person who told me that, I want to know what I did for God. What do I give God back for this tremendous gift that he's dropped on me? How do I do this? And they looked at me very simply, and they said to me, what I did with my sobriety would be my gift to God. Now, I thought about that a great deal. I think about very little else in my lifetime. My sobriety is the most priceless gift that I possess. I don't do anything to put it in jeopardy. I live no way contrary to a teaching. I treasure it above all things. If what I did with my sobriety would be my gift back to my loving Father God, I would only pray for one thing and one thing only for as long as I live. I would only pray that my loving Father God would be as pleased with my gift to him today as I've been with his for 26 years. Thank you.